طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We have a very full program for you this morning as we feature a former Israeli soldier, Aaron Efrati, who has seen the light and is now a fervent voice for Palestinian rights and a sharp critic of the Israeli-U.S. occupation of the Palestinian homeland. We run a bit long this morning, so let's get right to Aaron Efrati's presentation, recorded exclusively for This Week in Palestine.
I'm really, really excited to be here. And I'm really happy that you're here because it's important for me to be in Boston, in the Boston area specifically, because I don't know if you realize, but this is one of the most important sites of policing, of understanding policing, understanding oppression of different communities in this country, and in highlighting the relationship with Israel and the Israeli military specifically. And I'm excited to be here among activists. And among people that are actually, it was great just listening, go around the room and hearing where you come from and what you represent. I love these intimate settings. I'm doing events and workshops with groups from the Arizona border and LA and California all the way to New York. On all sides, I spend most of my year and my life in Jerusalem, back home. I'm doing my research there and my work there, and I'm coming to publish here because restrictions, censorship, and stuff like that there. And many times I'm going into rooms of 100 to 500 people in a classroom, in an auditorium, for a church. And I have to say that this is, and I'm not just saying it, the best setting for me. The ability to have a conversation, a real conversation, I even feel awkward standing up right now. I feel like we need to sit in a circle and just talk. The idea of just having a conversation with a small presentation, but actually hearing from one another, how can we be involved? What are the next steps that we can take? What is the background of this whole story, this deadly exchange, and the military industries that Steve just mentioned? To break it down a little bit and have a conversation about how all of us can be involved here and how we can change realities on the ground in Palestine, but back home in the U.S., is my favorite thing. And this is something that you can only do in this intimate settings of Bob Dylan songs and Kumbaya and, you know, having candles. So, my name is Aaron Efrati, and I'm the executive director of RAYA. RAYA is researching the American-Israeli Alliance. And we started RAYA about a year and a half ago after working, like Steve mentioned, in many different positions in this country as a researcher. And as a contributor to special committees by the UN and the ICC and others, we understood there's a lack of in-depth research in the movement for justice in Palestine, but also in the movements for racial and economic justice in this country. There's amazing activists that are doing amazing work like you for, you know, dozens of years, but there is a lack of understanding of research, definitely of research in Hebrew or in Arabic, on our subject, specifically research into the companies, into the money behind the scenes. And we, a bunch of us, just left all the stuff that we were doing at the time and decided to dedicate all of our time to create an organization that only supplied research to activist groups and organizations. Our first campaign, our first contract was Jewish Voice for Peace, that contracted us to make the Deadly Exchange report that I will talk about a little bit and can tell you where you can find and download for free. It's a 50-page report that just explains and breaking down the past 16 years of police exchanges from the U.S. to Israel for both directions. And we worked on their campaign. The second campaign that we're working on right now, as well as the police, is a project for the BNC, the Boycott National Committee in Ramallah, that contacted us to do a project about the Israeli academia. This year, PACB is taking on the Israeli academia to try to explain to people that it's not only one department or a few departments that are working with Israel as an arm of state violence or with the Israeli military, but it's really the university structure as a whole, the academia in Israel as a whole, which act as an arm of state violence in Israel. And we can talk about it all a bit in the end. Before I start this, I just want to say a few more words about myself, and I'm not going to go too deep because I know that all of you are already understanding the reality on the ground. I don't need to convince you. A lot of times I'm going into universities or into activist meeting groups, and there's a sense of me trying to explain to people that I came from a very Zionist background and a very militaristic background, and how I did my transformation, and I'm trying to pick people with me. I'm not going to try to do it with you. I understand that we're all on the same page here, but I do want to tell you just a few words so you know who I am. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I'm a seventh generation Jerusalemite. My grandpa was born in the old city of Jerusalem. My grandma was born in Jerusalem. My grandparents from my father's side came from Iraq originally, but for generations were in Jerusalem. My parents from my mother's side, both Holocaust survivors from Hungary. I grew up with a mother who was an officer in the military, one brother who was an officer in the Israeli military, and a father who was an officer in the Israeli military, and then the head of investigation of the Jerusalem police, and then the head of investigation of the West Bank police. So I'm coming from a good family. And I was supposed to be next one in line. I was supposed to be the next officer of the family. I was excited about that. I find myself joining the Israeli military, going into boot camp to be an infantry soldier. I joined the Nachal Brigade. I went through 7 months of boot camp. In my time there, we trained every day to fight in a war, the war with Syria, with Lebanon, with Egypt. We trained daily for a war, but in the end of the 7 months, I find myself in the middle of Hebron, of El Khalil, the biggest Palestinian city, in the middle of Palestine, counting then at the time around 180,000 Palestinians, and in the middle of the city, a Jewish settlement counting at the time around 750 to 800 Jewish settlers. Around them, 500 soldiers like myself. Around us, 300 policemen like my dad. And very quickly, I will understand that I'm not fighting any war and I'm not protecting my country. I'm enforcing an apartheid regime, and I'm doing it with American weapons, with American bullets, with American contracts, and with American supervision. That will be my introduction to this topic. We're talking about 15 years ago, my introduction to the idea of exchanges, security exchanges between American police and American military to the Israeli military comes when I'm still in Hebron and we see delegations of American police in uniform getting into Hebron in a delegation and coming to observe our work. To prepare for their coming, we would, through a curfew, we'll do a curfew in the city of Hebron. You all know what a curfew is, how a curfew looks like. Yeah. So we would go out in a city of, again, 180,000 Palestinians. We will go out and just close everything. All the shops are closed. Everybody needs to go home, sometimes for a few hours, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for a few weeks. In the past, we also had months of curfew at a time. Nobody can go in and out. And we would do this special curfew specifically for the demonstration that we're going to pull for the American law enforcement that came to see us. We knew it was a big deal. We didn't completely understood what's going on. The only thing we knew was that there's going to be a demonstration of force. Because usually when you're trying to enact a sudden curfew or trying to close shops, to take possessions from people, to separate people, separate families into different locations, you use a lot of arrests and you use a lot of weapons, disturbance weapon. And what you immediately create, and it's something that we can also see in the Gaza border in different places, and we can go into it a little later in the discussion, is that Israel is trying, or the Israeli army is trying, to create a scenario in which there is a resistance. There is no other choice except to resist, sometime by force or a little force compared to the force that the Israeli army used, from the Palestinian side. If it's stones throwing, if it's just having a protest, if it's trying to use any other kind of violence with weapons or without, and give us a good reason to start firing the place out. Mm. And when we do it, we use all the ammo that we have. Our knowledge in Hebron was that everything that we will finish, every ammunition that we have and we finish that day, will be replaced the day after. And we're talking about from tear gas canisters to rubber bullets, that by the way are of course not rubber bullets, mm-hmm. they're still bullets with a little bit of rubber around them, all the way to actual bullets, real regular bullets, and shooting, the use of drones, armored vehicle, tanks, shells, and collective punishment. All of that was in effect, and it was especially in effect when police delegations and American delegations came. I have a story about how I left the military. I don't know if you wanna go into it or not, but I I'll go. So I at some point after a few months of doing these things in Hebron, it was very clear to me that what we're doing is terrible. I mean, it was very clear to me that I am in some kind of a distress. I grew up learning that there is a right thing and a wrong. There's history, and I want to be on the right side of history. My grandma is an Auschwitz survivor. It was important for me to know that I am with the good guys. I think that every kid grew up thinking he is with the good guys. For me, it was a shock to understand that I'm not. And I got quite distressed. I went back home during those weeks, during those periods in Hebron, and I wasn't myself. I didn't recognize myself in the mirror. My mother didn't recognize me. We had a very hard and difficult moment to realize that I cannot continue my life the way it is. And the only thing I thought about doing at that moment was to give a phone call to a friend that I knew from a few years before that. He was the only lefty friend that I had. He was the only guy from a lefty family that I had any contact with. And the only reason I have his phone number was because he was really good at basketball. So I kept it. And I gave him a call. And his family was this lefty family, and he told me, look, Ilan, if you really want to understand what you're doing, what the implication of what you're doing is on people, you should consider the next time you're leaving the base and coming back home, instead of going to Jerusalem, go to Tel Aviv and come with anarchists against the wall to a protest in the village of Bilin. And I said, no. Protest with anarchists against crazy anarchists, throwing stones, no way. I am out. And my friend basically told me, well, Ilan, what do you got to lose? And I said, you know what? I don't think that I have anything to lose at that moment. And the next Friday I left for home. I put my uniform in a civilian bag. I put civilian clothes on me. And I find myself in Tel Aviv on a bus with anarchists against the wall that, by the way, are like a bunch of academic nerds. I have no idea. Anarchists against the wall. And we will get into Berlin. And I will be terrified. I was just terrified. It was my first time in the middle of a Palestinian village alone, without my unit behind me, without my six packs of ammunition, my M16, my two hand grenades, my vest, my helmet, and I was just terrified. All I heard was Arabic around me, and the only words I knew to say in Arabic were basically strip down and give me your ID. So I couldn't say that. And there was a few speeches, and then protests just start walking into the direction of what was then was still a fence. Today is a 20-foot concrete wall. Or 8 feet. I don't know how to do the conversion. 3 feet or...
20 feet.
Okay. 20 feet, 8.
How many meters?
I think it's 8.
8 meters, 24 feet.
It's 26 yards.
So today it's a concrete wall, and then it was still a fence, and there was marching into the direction of fence, and I'm just terrified. I see drumming, and I see speeches, and I see people walk, and I just waiting to get the hell out of this village. I'm so scared that someone from the village is going to hurt me. That's the only thing I'm thinking about. I'm afraid of the Palestinians around me. And then in the corner of my eye, I see a few young men that are rising up and start throwing stones. We're still a mile away from the fence. We're very far. But a few kids are starting to throw stones in the direction of the fence. And then immediately, 360 around us, they're popping up units of the IDF and start shooting at us directly. They're shooting tear gas canisters and rubber bullets into our bodies. And I'm just terrified, you know, because I shot at people before, but nobody has ever shot at me back. And I was so scared that the only thing I can think about doing, people are running around me. And the only thing I could do is just say, stop shooting, stop shooting! I'm an Israeli soldier! I'm an Israeli soldier, stop shooting! And one of the anarchist guys looking at me like this. I'm an Israeli soldier too! You can stop shooting! And a bunch of Palestinian kids are saying, it's okay, we got it under control, go home! But they didn't stop shooting. And I felt like I was just completely choked up. I don't know if you had the misfortune to have tear gas canisters around you in your life, but we trained with them in the boot camp, but it was nothing like that. That was a developed and enhanced tear gas canisters that we never experienced. And I just felt like I cannot breathe. I was on four in the middle of the village. People were running by me. I thought, this is it. This is how I'm going to die. Until a young Palestinian man that passed me and realized that I'm not dealing with this very well, came back just for me, picked me up, took me into his home in the village, and that was it for me. I mean, I know that I'm not going back to do the same things again. I left the military eventually. It still took me a few months. I worked with Breaking the Silence and with Doctors Without Borders from inside the military. I gave medicine and permits to go through checkpoints into hospitals in Hebron and South Mount Hebron as a soldier. I left the military and I started doing research immediately. For me, it was obvious that I want to understand why I was lied to. I want to understand who is profiting from this, who's making these tear gas canisters, who's making this weapon. And I went into a first phase of researching by just interviewing soldiers. I would go and interview soldiers through my role as in Breaking the Silence for 2.5 years. And at some point, I understood that I'm not getting anywhere because I'm interviewing people that are telling me important stories that needs to be shared with the world, but they all believed what I believed going in. Some of them believe it's for security, some of them believe it's just racism, some of them believe it's wrong, but none of them could talk about why are we actually there, who is profiting from us being there. And going deeper into research, I worked for the Washington Post for a year, and going deeper and deeper into the research, there's two things I encountered. The first was money, and the second was the U.S. In every corner I turned, I got back to the U.S., and I got back to money and to private companies. It got into a certain point when I researched a tear gas canister in 2008 that was sold from Israel to the government of Singapore, that in the press release that was out in 2008, Israel basically said this tear gas canister is the most developed and most deadliest tear gas canister ever produced in the world. And I remember sitting and thinking, who the hell will produce something like that? And who the hell will be tested on? And this realization, of course, that I was working in a laboratory for years, forced as someone who's testing the weapons on human beings, and then later, in the last almost 15 years, as someone who joined the protesters and Palestinians as a lab rat, as someone who runs from these weapons. And my research became more and more specific. I hit a wall at some point with the Israeli censorship. In Israel, I started being interrogated in the end of 2000, after the Kessler operation, in the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, and the Washington Post gave me a visa to come to the U.S. and continue publishing stories. Here in the U.S., I would give research into journalists, and they would publish it later on in The Guardian. And then I had the opportunity to go back and remember my time as a soldier when American law enforcement used to come. And remember that this is something that I really want to research. And I think this will be a good kind of segue to go back. Where should I go? I'll stay here. To go back and try to understand what we're talking about. So the conversation continues. I just want to show you a few slides that maybe demonstrate. If you don't see, I can read some of it out loud.
Would you like to sit here?
No, I think it's... Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Mr. Slandin, mm-hmm. Can you see?
Yes.
Nobody can see it here.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. So you can hit it. Let's start. So this is obviously the Gaza border. I could just as easily put the U.S.-Mexico border here in the slideshow, right? There's 100 snipers that are on the border at every given time since March, and they're waiting for protesters from Gaza to come close to the border from different angles to shoot them up. And I think this image is quite famous. A lot of people understand what's happening. A lot of people, of course, you know that there's more than 200 Gazans that got killed in the last 6 months. It's much more. It's since March.
Yeah.
So almost a year now of protesting, but we don't hear enough, even in our circles in the left, what kind of weapons are being in use on these borders. And the truth is that most weapons that is being shot at the border right now are weapons that are being manufactured in cities across the U.S. And that in some way, your money, your tax money, is paying for them. And we're going to get that. So you can hit it again. And this is just a picture from the village, from Belin, from my time there, of the tear gas. You can move on as well. So Steve touched it in the beginning, and I kind of want to elaborate. When my research started to go into the collaboration between police, the American local police, and the Israel military 10 years ago, I never dreamed that we get to where we are today. And maybe I did it yesterday in Cambridge, maybe I should start with the end instead of the beginning. The end is that yesterday we had an exciting event in Cambridge. We had an event, we had a full room with activists from different groups and different areas and individual activists that came together to a very energized conversation about why Boston is so important and what we can do here. So this conversation is following a great group that already is working here on the ground about what's happening. The other thing that Steve touched is that there's a delegation of the ADL. The ADL is sponsoring a free trip for policemen across this region to go to 10 days, fully paid, to Israel and train with the Israeli military on occupied ground, on occupied people, and to see for themselves some of the weapons that's being used on the ground. They're leaving this Sunday. I'm leaving on Monday to follow the delegation and to track them there for the next 10 days.
Wow.
So, like I did in yesterday in Cambridge, I will start by saying this conversation is not theoretical. It's very active, and we can see results of what's happening in the next few months. But already now, a part of this conversation, I hope, will be how we can strategize around this specific delegation and for the long run. And if you have any questions or stuff that you will want to know while I'm there in real time with the delegation, we can talk about it and we can be a part. I'm going to be in Palestine for the next 2 months, starting with this delegation. So what is this delegation? Where does it come from? Very shortly, a few months after 9/11, the collaboration and the connections between Israel and the U.S. obviously were forged dozens of years ago. It doesn't start from now. Israel and the U.S. worked in Latin America and in Africa during the 60s and the 70s. They made sure that they're selling weapons to the same side of regimes at the same time in a post-colonial time. So the collaboration was always there. But the U.S. was always the big player, and Israel was kind of getting the leftovers, in a way, in this world of what we call privatized security. Post-9/11 moment is happening, in which Israel is being held as the model of security. In the post-9/11 era, people are looking for answers, and Israel claimed that they have it. That was a very easy gateway to the government to approve starting sending delegations of police, local police, into Israel to train with the Israeli military and Israeli police. The first delegation that goes months after 9/11, really, just after 9/11, including NYPD, LYPD, but also agents that are going to build ICE less than a year after that, so from Border Police, and also workers of the MTA from New York. So transportation police is going with them. In the delegations after that, we will see a few other interesting actors. In the 16 years post 9/11, what we see is more than 40 states that sends more than 300 departments, agents, and offices to these delegations. So we're talking about across the United States. It's not in one location. We can identify a place. It's in big cities like Boston and in tiny cities and tiny communities that are sending their police officers to train within Israel military on military weapons and with military weapons that are coming back to the U.S. You can hit it again. But like I said, there's other agencies that are going from day one, including CIA and FBI and MTA, but also campus security. that is going with this delegation. So think about it. A university police or university security company will meet with FBI and CIA and local police and state police, all of them together in a place like Belin, to get a presentation about how you disrupt a protest. And then they come back here. And what they saw there is, how do Israel deal with our enemy, with the Palestinian, with terrorists? But when they come back here, they're just in your city and in your neighborhoods. And you, my friends, who are organizing protests and organizing events, become the enemy. So this is something that really affects all of us, and it's very scary. This is just a partial list of everyone that's going. Border police, ICE, for me, and university police are really highlighting how scary this situation is and who's really being impacted by it. Thank you, Michael. So the types of training they see, it will all go under anti-terrorism. And when you start organizing around this subject, all you will hear that this is just an anti-terror joint collaboration. One group going to the other to learn about the dangers of homegrown terrorism and outside terrorism in the post-9/11 moment. The truth is that what we learned from researching in depth for years, this delegation, is that under the banner of anti-terrorism, what they're really learning is a few things. The first is crowd control and riot disposals, the way they call it. Surveillance, deep surveillance of entire populations and the entire home, by using mostly racial profiling. You know, because in Israel, the use of racial profiling is so basic, is so ingrained into society, that the state itself, Israel itself as a state, is built on the idea of racial profiling. I mean, the idea of separating the Israeli Jews and Palestinians is based on the idea that we can identify who is who. Now, I said it yesterday in Cambridge, I'm going to say it again. Do you know how we say racial profiling in Hebrew? You don't. Because we don't. There is no term for racial profiling in Hebrew. Okay? It's so basic for us in the language that we didn't thought that we need to use it. When academics or activists are saying racial profiling, they're saying it in English. Racial profiling. Because it's so basic to us. The sponsors of these delegations, very important. Before I run on the sponsor, I will say we believe that these sponsors that we can target in local BDS campaigns can be very effective to understand what their motives are and to stop these delegations. But what we really believe in RIA, in researching the American-Israeli Alliance, that this is all what we call cover. Okay, a cover for something much deeper. A cover to what we see as the American-Israeli military-industrial complex. But let's run who's really paying for it. So we have two type of groups that are paying for this trip. The first is Jewish groups. Jewish groups, that their politics, their identity as Zionist groups, see themselves as wanting to help the connection, the collaboration between the U.S. and Israel, and they're doing it through police and military training. So you have AIPAC, that's not very surprising, and you have ADL, that shouldn't surprise you as well. But the ADL are a self-proclaimed civil rights organization. And a civil rights organization that is sending police officers to what they call themselves a war zone to train with the Israeli military. The ADL is probably, we can go down the list, but the ADL is probably the most important organization that you need to know about this region, because they are the main organization in this region that's sending the police departments to train in Israel. But we have others as well. And we can pull up these slides afterwards if you want the discussion, kind of share the names with all of you so you have it. So the funding goes through a few channels. Obviously, an organization like the ADL is a 501c3, so it's tax, you know, process in this country. But you have private corporations that are involved, and you have federal grants. And this is where it becomes interesting. You have federal grants like the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense that are sending money, but it's not on the books of these delegations. So what we saw through our research is that you have a grant for the Department of Justice, for example, that will send money into, for example, the ADL for different reasons. And then the ADL will funnel some of this money into these delegations, will pay for everything. You basically get a free tour, a free trip if you're a police officer, including the flight, the stay, the food, and everything in between. And the money is just appearing in the ADL bank account. Right, so it's private donations, but it's also the federal state that is sending the money. The one other thing that we're researching in Raya, according to the idea of this is much deeper than just this delegation, or what this delegation is really hiding behind them, is the 1033 program. Have you ever heard about the 1033 program? So the 1033 program is a program that started in the 90s under President Clinton in the U.S. as a way to fight in the war on drugs. And basically what it says is that local U.S. Police departments can receive surplus military gear being funneled from the military after being used in Iraq, for example, in the Gulf War, into their departments, and use them. Now, in the post 9/11 moment, what happened is that the program, the 1033 program, expanded dramatically, and the weapons started being used by local police members expanded dramatically. Now, we're not only talking about certain weapons that are scary enough, we're talking about drones, we're talking about tanks, grenade launchers that are all in the hands of local police departments. And what we did in RISE is start tracking all the police departments that we can with understanding of what kind of military weapons or technology they are hosting. Now, some of these weapons, some of these military tactics and weapons can be acquired by them after they went on the delegation, saw something they liked, and they can order it through the program, through the 1033 program. Now, there's a caveat in the program. After you get this new toy, your tank, your drone, your grenade launcher, you have to use it in the first year of getting it. If you're not using it, it can be taken back and be redistributed. So police officers and police departments have an incentive to use military weapons on American streets so they can keep them and continue playing with them. You know what? Just before we talk, very quickly, we're talking about planes and helicopters, armored vehicle, full body gear, grenade launchers, like we said, assault rifle. I mean, all of this stuff are insane enough when we're talking about American colonialism around the world. But again, this is all weapons that are in the middle of Detroit, Philadelphia, Boston. The Boston Police Department have military weapons, and it is in use for certain communities. So what are they actually learning there? You know, we can sit here in the room and claim, and we will be right, that U.S. Local police departments do not need Israel to act as an arm of state violence. That they were targeting certain communities of colors and other communities, Muslims in this country, for years. They didn't need this training. But they are going and they are learning specific things. What Israel is calling a battle-proven tactics and weapons. They learn how to control a population all together while still claiming that they are a democracy, while still claiming that this is for security. There's something unique in these delegations because it's not delegation to places like Russia or Syria or China where the governments just don't care about the appearance, where the government just claim that they are dictatorships and they don't care. Israel is playing this delicate balance with the world of we're still a democracy that defends ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. love the sounds of that. Mm-hmm. So there are stuff that has been learned. What we learned specifically that is being exchanged is A, expanded surveillance. So deep surveillance, the Israeli corporation and the Israeli private companies of surveillance are the leading companies in the world. And we're talking about all the way from video cameras and drones, where Israel surpassed the United States in 2012, and now the leading sales country or sales industry in the drone efficacy, all the way to private companies that supply local police department here the ability to tap every one of our phones at will, and it's in use in this area. The second is racial profiling. Again, how do you do an effective racial profiling across the country, and it's in use very close to here, and we'll talk about it in a second. And the last one is suppressing of public protests and use of force. What Israel does, and if we really want to strip it down, a lot of people can talk about the brilliance of the Israeli model, the golden model of security. What Israel really does is that they have one of the strongest military in the world against civilians. That's the bottom line. When you get to a protest in a village and all you have is kids with stones in their hands and you have tanks and airplanes and machinery, you will always win. It's not that difficult. The question is, are you willing to go this extra mile and just shoot at kids and women and men and civilians? So, just to explain the things very quickly with a few concrete examples to each one. When we're talking about civilians, did you all heard about the demographic units? So the NYPD post 9/11 is starting a new unit called the Demographics Unit. You can also know them as under the name Musk Crawlers. They will go, it's Middle Eastern men from NYPD that will go disguised to Muslims into masks across the cities, in the region in New York, and will start collecting intel about the people that are coming to praying. But not only that, if they will suspect anyone of doing more than just being a part of the community, talking about what they claim is terrorism or any resistance to the current government, they will disappear from New York. We're talking between 2002 and 12 into black sites in Chicago and New York, where they will be interrogated without the presence of a lawyer or their family knowing. We're talking about completely the Palestinian model on U.S. citizens. Yeah. The demographic unit was exposed in 2012, and they, in the hearings that were at the time in 2012 out in public, they admitted that they modeled the demographic units on a unit in the Israeli military called Mistalavim. Mistalavim in Hebrew means to be Arab or to become an Arab. Mistalavims are a bunch of soldiers, a unit in the Israeli military, of people looking like me, Arab Jews, that will go into Palestinian communities and will embed themselves in the community and will start riots or will start problems like the young man that I told you threw stones in the beginning of the protest. Sometimes they will start some kind of riot, so the Israeli army will have a reason to fire the place up. Sometimes they will just make arrest from inside the community in the middle of the night or track people. So there are police units that are already modeled on these tactics. The second is racial profiling. Racial profiling, the easiest model to talk about is the airport model. Almost every airport in the United States right now is using Israeli technology and Israeli tactics. But do you know which airport was the first one to use the Israeli model?
Boston.
The Logan Airport. The Logan Airport was the first one that hired officially the man that was in charge of the Israeli airport security systems in the entire country. They brought it into Logan Airports in 2007, and since then it spread across the United States. Almost every airport is using special cameras and special techniques of the Israeli technology. And the last one is the use of force. Now, in the use of force, we can talk about countless weapons and countless technologies that are being used on the ground in the U.S. right now in the past 15 years or so, but I want to focus on one specific, and that is the Tavor. The Tavor gun is an automatic rifle that basically was supposed to replace the M16. So Israel used the M16, the Israeli military used the M16 for years, and at some point the Israeli industry decided that they want to replace it with an Israeli manufactured automatic weapon to start having their soldier use in Palestinian cities, in East Jerusalem and in different places. We called it a Tavor, and we are using it right now since last March on the Gaza border. So most of the sniper weapons that we see on the Gaza border are the Tavor. But except for us using it, the Tavor right now, the Israeli automatic rifle, is used in PDs across the country. There's 15,000 holds across the U.S., including citizens, that can buy it directly from the company that manufactured it in Israel but sells it in the U.S. And PDs, again, we're going back to the point that we talked about earlier, can order it after they've seen it in use, and can receive it under the 1033 program, the surplus monitor program. So this is right now in Gaza, one of the new things that we saw and we didn't saw before. And I said in the beginning, we have to look at what happened on the Gaza border as a site for testing of new technology. Is a drone that is not only surveilled what's happening underneath him, but dropping tear gas canisters on protesters from the air by a push of a button. From afar, this is something that we predict in Raya that we will see in American streets or, of course, on the U.S.-Mexico border very soon. and Israeli technology that is already being viewed by these delegations. These delegations, except for going into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and different places, will go into Bilin on a Friday to see a protest, will go to the Gaza border. So local police departments of the U.S. will go to the Gaza border and sit on the Gaza border and will see how the Israeli army is treating the border and border security. They will go to military prisons across the country. They will meet with Palestinian political prisoners. They will understand how they work. They will go into Bethlehem and they will meet Palestinian local police, and they will learn how Israel is activating the local police, a Palestinian local police, to work for them. That's one of the things that's really interesting them. They will meet with media people and learn how the Israeli army can show the narrative that is coming out from every department. Again, something that's really interesting them. And they will go into private Israeli weapon companies and talk with them about the possibility of using some of this technology. Thank you, Noble. So, you know, this is, we talked about the 1033 program and the need to use some of this technology and some of these weapons in the first year. This is a picture you all know from Ferguson 2014, of course. The use of armored vehicles wasn't there only because we have militarized police and these delegations are enforcing and enhancing this militarized police, but also because they really have to use this technology and weapons. They have to use tanks going into civilian streets and inner cities in this country if they want to keep their toys. So again, I thought it was incredible. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up because I really want to have a conversation. I will just say one last thing, and that might be the bottom line of all of this and why we have to care and why we have to be a part of it, because we are all already a part of the problem. And I want to go out with talking a little bit about the Israeli-American military-industrial complex. I touched on it before, but I want to kind of explain what I mean. So you all know about the military aid package, right? You know that the U.S. has given Israel military aid since 2007 until 2018. There was one deal for 10 years that basically means that your tax money is going in the form of $30 billion over the course of 10 years, $3 billion every year to Israel in military aid. Now, it increased through the years. It was 3.1 and 3.2, but $3 billion every year, and there was a lot of support for it, obviously, in the government. And there was some opposition, some good opposition, some campaigns to end the $30 billion to Israel. But even the opposition usually talked about how the United States has given presents to the Israeli army, how you, with your tax money, are just giving presents to the Israeli military. They didn't talk about how these deals were actually structured. So in the last 10 years, the deals were structured in a way that 74% of the military aid was had to be bought in American contracts from private companies in the U.S. of weapons to be used in Palestine, and 26%, a little less than 26%, could have been used by the Israeli own industries, military industries in Israel to develop and sell their own weapons. It was a deal that no other country in the world received from the U.S. except for Israel. Israel had the ability to become one of the most important, influential, and largest weapon companies as a country, as a state, in the world. So much so that in 2012, something dramatic happened. India is the biggest buyer of weapons in the world, and the U.S. was their main supplier for years. In 2012, a second before another contract was signed for the next 25 years between the United States and India, for the buy of drones and technology, Israel basically bumped the U.S. and won over a contract. That's something that resonated with the government for many years. And in 2016, something interesting happened. President Obama, as a parting gift, in September 2016, just before he left office, decided to sign a new military aid package with Netanyahu. Now, the years before that, there was a lot of conversation about the tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, and nobody completely understood how his government, from all governments, decided to up the new military aid package for the next 10 years that is in effect right now to $38 billion, $3.8 billion every year to the Israeli military. And again, there was a lot of support, and a few people in our circles in the Movement for Justice in Palestine and Economic Justice here in the U.S. that say, why are we doing this unprecedented amount of money into a military that is very rich, very successful, and oppressing millions of human beings without any basic rights. But what people did not talk about enough was the caveat and the fine print of this new contract. So when the contract was signed, it was up to $38 billion. But what we didn't talk about was that the amount, the percentage that have to be bought from America in contracts went up to 100%. So 100% of the military aid is now being bought from private companies in the U.S. We all need to understand those deals, and we all need to understand the military aid package as a way for U.S. Military industries to profit, to make a killing, literally, on the backs of Palestinians. It's money that is being funneled into private companies that send their technology and weapons to be tested on human beings on the other side of the world before coming back here, being sold around the world as battle-proven, and being used here in the U.S. This is in many, many ways a local issue, not a foreign policy one, but a domestic one that you have the power to influence. And this is our website, PalestineIsHere.org. Palestine is Here is a database that Raya created, researching the American-Israeli Alliance, my organization, created for activists across the country. If you go to PalestineIsHere.org, you can do two things. The first is you can put your zip code or your address in it, and you can learn which police officer, police department, TSA, ICE agent trained from your area in Israel in the last 16 years. We still have thousands of names that are being uploaded every week into the database because part of our process is to proof all of this data. And there's a lot of data that we achieve, and we want to make sure that we get it right. So if you don't see your local police department there, wait a week or two, they're probably going to be there. The second thing that you can do, except for track that and understand who's already working on the ground to oppose this delegation, is to go into the reports tab on the website and download for free a report about the end of deadly exchange that we wrote for Jewish Voice for Peace about their very successful campaign, and to read about this background, to understand this background. Now, the last week was full of surprises because I told you that on Sunday, the delegation of the ADL is traveling to Israel, and I told you that on Monday I'm going to track them. What I didn't tell you, and maybe some of you heard today, is that behind the scenes, we were working for the past few weeks after realizing who the police officers that are traveling to start and create local groups in their towns, putting pressure on their city council, their police departments, to stop this delegation from happening, to stop their agents, their policemen, from traveling to Israel. And in unprecedented moment, we got two huge wins last week. The Vermont State Police officer that was supposed to be on the trip and got some pressure from its community decided to cancel and pull out in the last minute. Mm-hmm. And the second police officer was from?
Northampton,
Massachusetts. Yay. Now, we really believe...
Chief of Police.
The chief of police. Yeah. We really believe that there is a Boston Police Department officer sitting on this delegation. And already today, after our meeting yesterday in Cambridge, there was a letter coming out to the mayor, asking him to immediately look into it and try to explain to us, like to explain to all of you as activists in this city, how can a police officer that is in charge of your security in this city go and train with a military force on military ground on occupied people. So there's already a campaign full going on, and this is the time to jump on it. The one really last thing that I want to share with you, just before we go jump into a conversation, is just something remarkable that happened. And I shared it yesterday in Cambridge, and I thought it was strong. In 2016, there was something interesting that was going on. I'm interviewing a lot of police officers and military officers that are traveling to Israel and training from both sides. In 2016, something happened that never happened before. I interviewed a few officers, Air Force officers from the U.S. military that traveled to Israel to train for over a month with another 1,000 officers from the U.S., including police and CIA and military, on the ground with the Israeli Air Force. It was something that never happened before. It was the largest number of U.S. Air Force or military personnel ever together in a training outside of the U.S. And when they came back, I just asked them, What did they saw there? And why was it important? Because I truly, with all my experience, couldn't understand. And all of them, all the people that I interviewed, said the same exact thing. They said, we have no idea. All we talked about for over a month was short-range missiles, Lebanon, Syria, all kind of threats that we just do not have in the U.S. We have no way to implement any of the things we talked about here. But all of them also said another thing. Throughout the month, all the time, people in suits came in and out of the rooms, and we got presentations from private companies on private missiles and defense mechanism that were in the room. I still couldn't completely understand what they were doing there, and about 3 months after that, we got an answer. Lockheed Martin published that their new airplane, F-35, that's supposed to replace the F-16 airplane, in billions of dollars, is being sold to Israel exclusively under the new military aid package that is going to come about. And Israel just bought in one night more than 100 airplanes that Israeli officials, Israeli Air Force pilot said they do not want to use. Another unprecedented thing, the Israeli army coming out against a government, the US government, the Israeli government, that are creating a deal with a local private company. The Israel pilots are saying, we know about the F-35 for years. It's a bust. Yeah. American pilots do not want to use it. They're saying it's dangerous for the pilots themselves. Forget about the people being affected or targeted by this war airplanes. They say we don't need this and we're afraid to use it. We refuse to receive those airplanes. We should go back on the deal. But of course they couldn't, because if we're getting money to buy these airplanes, then we have to follow through. So Israel is buying more than 100. We already have around 50. There's another around 70. They're on the way of F-35. But there is a discussion coming out in Israel, something unprecedented. There's a war between the military, like I said, and the government. And we, the citizens, are being exposed to it for the first time, to this tension. And then something truly amazing happened that didn't happen to me in my years of researching or my years as a human being or as an Israeli. Lockheed Martin, a private weapon company located in the U.S., is buying a full ad page in Haaretz newspaper, Haaretz, like the left, it's supposed to be the lefty newspaper in Israel, the liberal left newspaper in Israel, buying a full page ad and publicizing a message directed to Israelis in Hebrew. They're saying, congratulations, Israel, the F-35, the great one, the Adil in Hebrew, the great one, is coming home soon. A private weapon company talking to civilians on the other side of the world to quiet the conversation so it won't hurt their deal. We're all playing in a much bigger game that we want to admit. But it starts by putting pressure locally and BDS campaigns locally and understanding that the money that is coming out from here and going back to private hands and to private pockets in the U.S. is affecting millions of lives in Palestine and in the U.S. So let's talk about what we can do about it. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to former Israeli soldier and current activist for Palestinian rights, Aaron Efradi. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.